This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
I sense that we did not do in a detailed upfront script, knowing very well that this morning and the rest of the day would actually cover quite a bit of it. I've actually got four items here from an original script, two I think have been completely covered, and some backup. So I'm going to go through in bullet point form, just making sure I remind myself of some key points, but not dwelling on them because we've talked about it, and just spending a little bit more time on one or two of the others. But I'm really going to be quite quick, and it's probably more than enough for you anyway at this stage. If not, then you'll have to bang some questions back at me later on. I just need to actually make one slight explanation. The reason I'm not sat over there is because there's not a seat. It is nothing to do with the fact that there are two principals of colleges and two ex-principals of colleges there. I actually spend... Is there one there? Well, it's not big enough for me. I spend all my time sat at tables with principals and ex-principals and so on, not least of all the private dinners I enjoy regularly with Martin Dole. A lot of my members, of course, are very uneasy about this, but they're learning how important this collaboration and partnership is, and that is a serious point. Right, so what are my bullet points, and we can move quickly through some of them. Finalising the open market to make sense of flexibilities. Well, we touched on that quite a bit today. I don't want to go into that. I think there is an issue that some of the recent announcements must move us further towards a situation where the further education system and the providers in it, indeed it's populated by providers who are there because they, through quality criteria alone, are rightfully there, and there are no barriers. They've been moving away over recent years, and it's just a question mark that we may inadvertently start raising a few of them again. And I mentioned a few this morning about whether the flexibilities are going to be available to all providers. We will go for that. But that would be a great shame if we started to reverse a process which I think actually serves us quite well and certainly serves our customers. I'll say no more on that. One thing there which we haven't gone into today, because it has gone quiet politically, unless I just missed it, is the concept of skill accounts and learning accounts and so on. It's just interesting, hasn't come up today, and I think that does reflect the fact there's not been an awful lot said about it in the last 2 months. If anyone is more ahead of me, then they can catch me before I disappear. But that's quite interesting, because I think that was an approach which seemed to have very widespread support in terms of really making us more and more customer, consumer, student, whichever word you want to use, focused. Learner focus is probably the most common one. And what was interesting, I'm going to move straight through that as well, not to unpack it, because we don't seem to have dripped into it today. But what was very interesting is what follows on from skill and learning accounts, which was the concept, obviously, of what the original white paper, the previous government's white paper, called approved training organisations, who would be the people who would be able to be accessed by choice by learners. In ALP, the term we've used now for nearly a decade has been an understanding of the concept of preferred suppliers, where there are very clear quality thresholds to get through, track records and so on, and that on that the future is based. So I'm a bit concerned that in the present, one or two of these things seem to have gone a bit quiet, and I think they are very, very important to us that we actually do look at that. And the fourth of the original points has been touched on. It follows on from that as well. And that is the very real impact of the minimum contract levels. I mentioned it and asked, I think, Jeff a question about it. He mentioned it anyway in his presentation this morning. The impact of minimum contract levels on the sector. No doubt we have too many direct contracts. I haven't got a problem with that. Some of my members won't be very pleased to hear me confirm that, but that is our view. I think we have got it far too complex, and we have got to move very, very sensibly to make sure the quality provision that is out there, often in some very small organisations in the third sector, private sector, and some niche delivery in the public sector as well, that quality provision is not lost by the need to really squeeze down on the administrative costs, which all of us want to see reduced. I mean, that's a common view. But there are some dangers as we go down that particular track. that takes us all into the collaboration agenda, which is a theme which has been very strong through the day. So again, I'm not going to push that any further. We've had quite a debate on that as the day's gone forward. But I think the collaboration issue is very, very important as we reduce the number of direct government-funded contractors, but make sure we do not jeopardise or overly threaten high-quality provision, which doesn't fit into a neat and inexpensive bureaucratic position. And I think there's an awful lot of work that needs to be done. Now, I was just going to talk about those four originally. I'm going to give you a couple of other one-liners. I know time is running on. Some of my backup points for flexibilities, we've had a talk about that, so I'm not going to go there. Other than, again, the very real danger here that the welcome flexibilities announced only this week could really threaten the government, who are losing targets. But as someone else has reminded us, we did have our first target when John Hayes stood up and said 50,000 new apprenticeships in the financial year. I have reminded him already how welcome that target was, coming from where I come from, because it's good news for any provider that's in the apprenticeship game, and that's the vast majority of colleges as well as the vast majority of independent providers. But it's quite interesting, the kind of flexibilities he's talking about available to the college sector with your adult learning responsive budget, which is not available. We were moving towards it in the independent sector. It's quite interesting to see whether there is a movement away from apprenticeship employer responsive funding into adult learning responsive, given that environment opportunity. It's not for me to tell individual providers, certainly not ALP members, what to do, but I am telling my members this. For goodness sake, that's a direction I would advise against, because I think it will catch up with you. It's very interesting that the opportunity for providers to move in the wrong direction, I think, was given this week. And I think it's a very interesting point to see how that will be, in fact, managed and dealt with over the next year or two. Mentioned something briefly about standards. Melanie has actually promised she's going to get me for it at some future stage. And actually, interestingly, it wasn't Ofsted I was after when I mentioned this morning about standards. ALP believes Ofsted ought to stay. Interestingly, we've had quite a bit of debate about it. What we want to get rid of is the multitude of quality standards that providers of all sort have to hop through. That's what's wrong in the system. And our view at the moment, and we've not explored this with AOC and 157 and others yet, and it's a debate we ought to have sooner rather than later, especially if we were to agree on it, and I'm not making that assumption at the moment. I mean, I really do believe that we ought to be moving to a situation, Jeff Russell helpfully mentioned it, more and more based on funding outputs, outcomes. Outcomes is probably a better word than outputs, but let's keep it simple for now. Let's really move towards funding what people ultimately, what the government ultimately want to buy on behalf of the consumers. Let's move towards a simple system where we're measuring the achievement of outputs. We have that data now. And let's make sure we contract with people who get the right levels of outputs and just assure ourselves under a preferred supplier basis that they have solid quality assurance systems which are being properly worked through day by day. That's all we need. To contract, it ought to be an organisation with a track record, with a clear quality assurance system, and then you check the outputs. And I mentioned earlier on the importance of the awarding bodies in there. I think it would be very simple indeed. Where I would use Ofsted, if I may, and it hasn't got to be Ofsted, but they're well positioned for it, is that any organisation, not just in the FE sector, this is across business, not a word we use very often in the FE system, I have to say, but across the whole of the business, industrial, commercial sector, where good operators in any field have a good quality assurance system, you will find it strongly based on a system. It could be of their own making. It could be one bought off the shelf. It will have self-assessment against the things they ought to be doing to be a successful business. And guess what they'll do? They'll self-assess and self-assess. And every now and again, they will get an independent check of that. They will ask and pay for a third party to come in every few years to actually check their own internal assessments. I thought, Melanie, quite a good role there. not a million miles away from where you are. I wouldn't leave at 6 years, and I wouldn't let anybody off the hook forever either, personally. It's an interesting view. I think there's some dangers in there. It's interesting the results of our little poll on that, wasn't it? It wasn't quite as some people would have expected. So I really want to push out all of these little different quality standards which have been designed by funders in government, and let's have a quality assurance systems designed by providers, which they take responsibility for, and actually have them independently checked at the request of the provider. And if they're not doing that, big question mark as to whether they should be getting government contracts. If they're not an organisation that sees that as the way of running a good organisation and looking at continuous improvement, beg the question as to why in the blazes we're giving them any money. And I would go really quite strong down that one. And I think we save a lot of money. Up goes the standard, in my view. Shared financing with employers hasn't come up today. I'm surprised it hasn't come up today. I have a view, if we get this right, and talking to David Willetts a few months ago before the election, I was really struck by the very clear, unequivocal position he took. And it wasn't talking about train to gain. It was talking about the new government at that stage, had they got in, and they have got in, but he's saying, and with the financial crisis, there's no way that any government can carry on pouring millions or billions of pounds into employers to help them train their own staff to do the job which they're supposed to be doing. And he was very, very clear about this, very, very clear, and I think it's an interesting exercise. I think that hasn't come out in the wash yet, but it will. And I think we're going to see employers asked to contribute, actually contribute money into the system, not nominal, over the next couple of years. If that is done right and sold right, and you don't tell employers to contribute to government policies, you tell employers, here's something which you've got to have. Guess what? We'll put some money towards it. There's a real difference here. If we get that right, you know, the shortfalls which may come up in government funding for skills and other training could well be met by employers. A thought for the future. I'm being looked at, nodded at, and so on. So there you are. If I have a chair there, I'll sit there.
Thank you very much.